Thanks so much. It's an honor to be presenting here, and thank you all for coming. So the title of this presentation is I Cry When I'm Alone, But I Don't Cry in Front of Them, which is a quote from one of my focus group participants. And this is presenting research about mental health and resilience among Palestinian mothers who confront political violence. I have no relationships to disclose. So according to the UN, the distinction between a war front on some distant battlefield and a home front, where women in particular carry on daily life as closely as possible to normal, if it was ever accurate, has now eroded. So war now permeates whole areas and embraces entire populations, or it can also persist in alternating between sort of high-intensity warfare, which is what we often think of when we think of political violence, and more low-intensity warfare, which is the kind of warfare that seeps into daily life and affects every part of somebody's life. And this is especially true with ongoing occupations in places like Iraq and Palestine. So this picture is from my research, and this is in the town of Halil, or Hebron. So it's a Palestinian area, and this shows Israeli settlements that are in the Palestinian area. And this is one of the areas where we did one of our focus groups. So what does this mean specifically about mothering? And the reason why this question really emerged is because a lot of research about political violence and mental health really focuses on children. And much of that research highlights how important processes of parenting, especially mothering, is for children's mental health. But it rarely focuses on the mother and what her processes are. So we have considerable evidence in general about the links between political violence and mental health, as well as multiple studies that demonstrate the importance of parenting for protecting children from the effects of war and conflict. In fact, some authors say that if parenting is done effectively, that no matter what the trauma is that the children are suffering, they'll be all right. Yet, and this is rarely talked about, political violence profoundly threatens the basic tasks of parenting just when they are most needed. When we think about the basic things that parents do for their children, most of those become either very difficult or downright impossible during political violence, especially protracted political violence. Literature in general, when we think about how violence affects mothering, is very slim, and even more so about how mothers strategize to keep themselves and their children safe. And these citations focus on violence both in terms of political violence, but also in terms of community violence and domestic violence. So there has been some work done about what mothers do within violent contexts, but that's really a very small body of literature. And then scholarship is even more limited when we look at political violence specifically, and not just how it affects mothering, but the associated risks that this poses to mothers' mental health. Although a few studies do point to mothers' expressions of helplessness, guilt, and distress when they cannot protect their children from the trauma and the humiliation of political violence. But really, there's very small literature on this, which is strange considering what a common problem it is trying to actually parent in these situations of ongoing political conflict. So with those questions, or with that scope of the literature, I asked a couple questions of my data. The first was, how does political violence affect processes of mothering? How do threats to mothering due to political violence affect mothers' mental health? And what strategies do mothers use to mother within political violence? This is part of a much larger study, which is a research collaboration in the West Bank with one of the largest NGOs in the area, the Palestinian Medical Relief Society. And they run a lot of different programs, including a community health worker training program, mobile clinics, mental health and community development programs. And these workers, especially the frontline workers, were really instrumental in helping set up the focus groups, and I really want to acknowledge the work that they did with that. The sample overall was adult women. We did both surveys and focus groups, although today I'll be focusing specifically on the focus groups. And that's my research team down there, so I want to acknowledge them. Participants were drawn from non-clinical client populations and a local university. And by non-clinical client populations, I mean they were there to visit an eye clinic, or they were there for sort of basic children's primary care. They weren't there for mental health care. So focus groups were done in the summer of 2008, and we did a series of five focus groups in five different regions of the West Bank. I use basic content analysis, and coding was done line by line. But I also used thematic network displays, a lot of different ones. And I'm not expecting you to see anything that's written on here, but just to know, one thing that was interesting was that I didn't go into these focus groups specifically wondering about the question of mothering. I was asking in general about how political violence affects women's mental health. But what I came to was that a lot of the themes really focused on this little diamond there, which was parenting. So this was really an emergent theme that came out of doing the analysis, that I realized so many of the women, even though I hadn't specifically sampled mothers, were talking about mothering and parenting when I asked them about political violence. So that was why I really focused to ask that specific research question. So within that, there were some major themes. The first was mothers' accounts of their children's suffering, which was a very common theme that women wanted to talk about at the focus groups. The second was the really profound yet very routine interruptions to their role as parents and the tasks that they tried to fulfill as parents. And then related to that was how that emotionally affected them. They also always talked about these regular ongoing strategies of resistance and resilience. So stories of resistance were always intimately connected to stories of pain and trauma. So first of all, what happened with children suffering? And this is a picture that I took in the West Bank of an Israeli soldier beating children at a checkpoint, beating Palestinian children at a checkpoint. So women talked about physical harm coming to children through things like death, jail, as well as lack of medical care. They talked about their children's obstructions to freedom, even just, you know, the ability to go outside and play or the ability to take their children to visit holy sites. And they also talked about what it was like to watch their children have to witness their parents' grief and their parents' helplessness. An overall lack of normalcy. So one woman said, there are kids who are 14, 15, 16, and what did they do wrong that they cannot continue their education? They will not let them continue their education. They just keep capturing them. All we see is them capturing these children. Another said, my daughter was 3. They entered our camp, and do you remember when they threw rockets on us? My daughter was so afraid, and I was trying to hold her with my aunt, too. It almost hit her. Ever since then, my daughter's always afraid. And one woman simply said, in the past, they used to only take them to jail. Now they kill them. It's harsher than before. People also really focused on this idea of the loss of childhood. One woman said, children don't see anything but this kind of treatment and occupation. Children no longer know the meaning of childhood because they can't live as children. So the second major theme was interruptions to parenting. Within all of that context of their children's suffering, what did women talk about in terms of their parenting? They talked about how hard it was to be there for their children. They talked about how impossible it was to provide for their children, both emotionally and financially. They talked about what it was like to no longer be able to protect children. And these are in line with theoretical frameworks that talk about the basic tasks of parenting, which suggests, for instance, one author suggests that there's 6 main tasks of parenting, and that's providing safety and sustenance for your children, socio-emotional support, stimulation or instruction, surveillance or monitoring, a sense of structure, and a sense of social connectedness. So you can imagine how these things get interrupted within political violence, and that's precisely what the women talked about. So what did they say? One woman said, I give him reassurance that things will be okay. I tell him that there's hope, but I can't do more than encourage him. I can't stop the fear that overtakes him. Another said, occasionally I travel with my daughter, and at the checkpoint, sometimes the Israeli soldiers start joking and laughing at us. And really what she's talking about here is what it's like to actually confront humiliation with your child. Another woman said, it's sad for us because we don't know what to tell our children about what the future holds. So it's not just, you know, what happens when the political violence intrudes in these sort of dramatic ways with bombings and guns, but it's also the general sense of uncertainty of a people that don't know how they'll be able to construct a future. Emotionally, women talked about several consequences, a sense of rage, fear, distress, and certainly helplessness. But they also talked about strength, which was a really important theme, and I'll get to that in just a moment. So one woman says, what affects you is when you see your son captive or wounded and you can't do anything for him. Another says, I cry when I'm alone, but I don't cry in front of them. Just to go back to this one, it was interesting because within the focus group context, there was an ongoing discussion between the women because some women said things like this, I don't cry in front of them, whereas other women said, I try to explain to my children what's going on. So there were these interesting conversations where women were saying, what's the best strategy? Do we need to tell our children about the context of the suffering, or do we need to protect our children from that? And that was a really interesting question that I think would be great to follow up on. So as we move into the idea about resilience, the facilitator asked, you had a boy who was a martyr, and still you worked to resist. And the woman said, the more they challenge us, the more I become resilient and strong. And that really captured the attitudes of resilience that a lot of women shared. So what are some of their strategies? A lot of their strategies had to do with promoting both individual and collective dignity and perseverance. The relationships between the individual and the collective were very tight, and some of the examples will demonstrate that. They also talked about just continuing to try to provide for basic needs, food, education, a sense of safety, a sense of normalcy. They did this through various ideas of strategizing. They tried to provide what reassurance they could. So one woman, for instance, said, once during the Intifada, they forbid me from visiting my son who was in prison. I was at a border, and they stopped me and wouldn't let me in. I defied them by talking to him through the prison walls. I was calling, Marwan, Marwan. My son came up to the wire fence, and I kept running to see him. I told the Israeli forces, I saw my son, and that's all I wanted to do, so do whatever you want. We need to be strong. Another says, we try to teach our children not to take advantage of others and to be fair and tolerant, to love each other, that everybody should live together, even though we do not have this opportunity. So that really speaks to thinking about mothering as a venue for teaching a cultural norm of value and respect, even in the context of this protracted conflict. They talked about just persisting to give their children love and affection despite all the difficulties. They talked about sort of a certain sense of acquiescence, having to take life for what it is. One woman said, we don't want our children to stop living, so we have to continue and accept the reality. But we should always give kids hope that things will change. So they talked about hope and courage. I won't read that whole quote, but they talked about hope and courage and not having shame. There were some limitations, obviously. The first is that we had a limited number of respondents and a potential selectivity bias that affects the transferability of the findings. The second is that, similar to what Aaron was presenting, a very tricky translation process. I didn't detail the translation process, which was sort of a three-stage translation process that included having two separate translators translate the focus groups and then myself and the original focus group facilitator working through the translated versions. But even with that, it was definitely subject to the many challenges inherent within cross-language research. But in general, results underscore the importance of attending to the effects of political violence on families. And it highlights the importance of attending to not only the protective effects of parenting, but doing it in a way that doesn't ignore the parent in that equation. We really have to think about how parents, and particularly mothers in a lot of cases when the burden of parenting really falls on mothers, how they actually strategize to fulfill their roles within political violence and the mental health consequences of doing so. We can't only talk about how they manage to persist, but what that costs them. So in general, further research is needed to more fully understand the health implications of women's experience as mothers within political violence. Thank you very much.